Connecticut Democrats, or Connecticrats, as they have never been called.
Welcome to Connecticrats, a CT Dems podcast. I'm David Kostek.
And I'm Tara Keeman.
Well, this week, Trump is running scared from a second debate, trying to make excuses about being a victim, about nothing but grievance and complaint, sort of standard fare for Donald Trump. But J.D. Vance can't get out of his debate coming up on October 1st with Tim Walz. Looking forward to that one. We talked a little bit about it on the last show, but now it's a little closer in time. You focusing on it?
I'm excited, but I'm also a little bit scared, especially seeing how easily J.D. Vance has been on the media airwaves talking about how he's totally okay with creating stories as long as they bring attention to whatever he finds salient. I'm hoping there's a lot less misinformation on the VP debate coming up.
Let's hear J.D. talking about making stuff up to make a point that doesn't exist.
The American media totally ignored this stuff until Donald Trump and I started talking about cat memes. If I have to, create stories so that the American media actually pays attention to the suffering of the American people, then that's what I'm going to do, Dan.
There was a time when you got caught in an outright lie, that was like a political liability. And it seems less so now.
Their strategy has become doubled down on everything and anything, which is incredibly harmful. But I think what was very interesting is he didn't just double down. He completely rationalized his thinking as being like a politically savvy move, which I hope that viewers find incredibly unsavory to see someone so blatantly be like, I am leading you down a dishonest path just so that you agree with me.
Yeah, you wouldn't be talking about this if I weren't lying about it, is a heck of a framing. That lie infested the presidential debate and kind of became the touchstone of it, something we played audio of on the last debate. I'm sure everyone has heard not only that audio, but a bunch of fabulous remixes and TikTok dances and everything else. But, the issue in Springfield, Ohio, that doesn't exist. This is what J.D. was talking about, and this is what Trump elevated. And it's had some serious implications and some serious ramifications.
I think it's very easy when you're coming from a logical standpoint to hear these kinds of things and take on this mentality of, this is a meme, this is funny, this is just so outrageous that people just don't take it seriously. But what we all need to keep in mind is that even if some people may understand that this is just so outrageous it couldn't possibly be true, there is a huge portion of the population that might actually not only be swayed by this, but also be empowered to act upon whatever they feel that they're being directed towards doing. And watching the fallout over that comment and how much hate and danger Haitian people have been put in, not just in Springfield, Ohio, but also just across the states, has been really, really terrifying to watch.
There have been bomb threats that shut down a number of schools and government offices in Springfield. The mayor there has said, you know, don't come. And of course, Trump is planning to now go to Springfield. I don't know if he'll follow through on that. It's you're right. It's terrifying and it has huge, huge ramifications. We're seeing counter rallies of Haitians and allies standing outside of Trump events, protesting, et cetera. Our own attorney general, William Tong, put a op-ed in a number of papers in Connecticut that was really stunning. I would encourage readers to seek it out. It ran on September 13th, so that would be like in the Connecticut Post, the Stamford Advocate, the Middletown Press, New Haven Register, Danbury News Times, any of those papers. I'm just going to read a segment of it, where this is, again, Connecticut Attorney General William Tong. Hate that turns into violence does not metastasize alone. These words justify action against people who, quote, do not belong here, end quote, the migrants, invaders who are, quote, destroying our country, who, quote, pollute and replace the blood of our nation. For the disaffected and angry, it is a short walk from here to where they pick up a gun and slaughter six Asian American women in a spa or in Atlanta, or shout, get out of my country, before firing at two Indian men at a bar in Kansas, or when they massacre 20 shoppers in an El Paso Walmart to, quote, stop the Hispanic invasion. He shares a number of stories from his own life growing up as in the son of Chinese immigrants who operated a restaurant, and hearing the same horrible sort of jokes and jabs about, you know, eating pets as well. And he talks about having to, like, sort of ignore it and turn the other cheek, and where now that he is in the position he's in, he's not going to do that anymore. When there was a wave of anti-Asian hate crimes a few years ago, he was also very much in the forefront of calling it out and taking action here in Connecticut to alleviate some of these things. And I certainly trust him to do that the same in this case.
I really appreciate his comments, and they remind me of two things that we talked about in a sociology class recently about these comments. The first being that it is very easy that when a large group of people are frustrated about something, whether that was COVID, whether that may be the economic state that Springfield, Ohio is in, the frustration with infrastructure, it is so much easier than doing the work to just shift the blame to a certain group of people. And I think it's very important to realize that when politicians do this, it's not just hate. It's also them not working for and serving for the people who are disserviced. You are manipulating large swaths of people to blame others rather than doing things that actually fix the genuine root of the issue that people are facing. And that displacement is honestly really scary. I think it's what creates a lot of that hate. Another thing that we talked about was the comment about eating cats and dogs. In the American psyche, I think that, like, pets are so incredibly important and people love their pets. And I think that it was very strategic to point out cats and dogs as a targeted and calculated point to be made, because I think they were aware of how they would that would fire up bases and get people concerned and clicking on things more so than anything else. And knowing that it's calculated, to me, is really, really critical in analyzing this issue.
There was another case of a former Republican mayor commenting on Facebook posts. That's Timothy Stewart. He used to be mayor of New Britain. His daughter, Erin Stewart, is the current mayor of New Britain. But Tim Stewart put another comment that sort of evoked racist stereotypes against Asians in a, you know, threat or comment to do with this. And, you know, they don't back down from it, and they sort of double down and continue to insist that it's okay to make, you know, these sort of jokes, and that to take some sort of umbrage or to call them out on it is a failing of Democrats. Well, we're going to keep doing it, and we're going to keep on applying pressure to people to recognize that what they're doing is absolutely wrong in the case of Vance or Trump, or whether it's a former mayor of New Britain.
Today on Connecticrats, we're joined by Nate Simmons, a candidate for the state senate in Connecticut's 36th district. With a rich background in education and public service, Nick has a unique perspective on the challenges of campaigning in today's divided political landscape. Welcome to the podcast, Nick.
Hi, Tara. Thanks so much for having me. Great to be here.
Nick, you're running in a particularly partisan time. We were just discussing the hateful rhetoric utilized in the recent Trump and Vance campaign. What challenges do you face while campaigning in such a divided political landscape?
Well, you know, my district is actually, a unique case study in this. So my district is the town of Greenwich, North Stamford, and New Canaan, which was for hundreds of years had always been kind of ruby red. And after Trump was elected in 2016, it sort of followed the trend that you're starting to see nationally, where some of these suburban districts that were previously pretty red are incredibly turned off by Donald Trump, by the MAGA movement, by the hatred and the vitriol that's coming out of that movement, anti-democratic, positions, anti-immigrant positions, anti-women positions. So that's why this district has turned more purple, if anything, trending blue. And so you're seeing the biggest voting block is now unaffiliated. So it's about 40% unaffiliated, about 31% Democrat and 29% Republican. And so a lot of those unaffiliated are very turned off by the hyper-partisanship that they're seeing, coming much more, honestly, from MAGA world than the Democrat world. For me, you know, when I'm out there campaigning and knocking doors, this is my home district, born and raised here. I do try to call back to a time when things were more civil, when growing up here, you know, this is the birthplace of George Herbert Walker Bush. I'm a very proud Democrat, but at least that kind of Republican was more civil, tried to be more bipartisan, tried to be forces that united the country versus divided the country. And I think that really resonates with a lot of voters in my district who are looking to get back to that kind of just practical unity and kind of getting things done to make everybody's lives a better place.
You've had a very interesting and, I guess, like, unique start in public service, serving as a seventh grade math teacher at a middle school in Harlem, and then at 26 years old, becoming one of the youngest acting principals in the state of New York. What inspired you to make that transition from education to running for state senate? And how has that experience kind of colored what you plan to do?
So it was the best experience of my life, getting to work with such incredible young people in Harlem. They are now all grown up. They are the same age today that I was when I was teaching them back when they were 10, 11, 12, 13. My students suffered from everything from homelessness to abuse. They would come to school hungry. But we created a school environment that wrapped our whole arms around them and tried to support every aspect of their lives beyond just education. So we extended the school day out to about 5:30 because almost all of them came from, you know, single parent working households. So parents were at work. We helped them find housing if we could. We helped parents find childcare. We helped them get healthy meals every day. And so to see them go on and thrive, almost all of them going off to college, being the first in their families to do so. You know, one of the best experiences of my life was getting to help one of my students named Mokhtar, who was homeless when I was teaching him. I got to help move him into his dorm at MIT by like 8 years later. So those kind of success stories inspired me to want to spend my career working to help communities I was a part of, to help them thrive. And they also showed me what's possible. You know, too often, I think we set a bar that's too low for the communities we're trying to help. And the reality is that every human being has within them incredible potential to thrive and succeed. And we just have to make sure we have a high bar in knowing what's possible through public policy. So that really inspired me to go out and try to spend my career working in government to try to implement, you know, more systematically reforms that could help communities, all communities, thrive no matter the zip code. And that's what led me to Governor Lamont's office.
Right. I was just about to touch on that. You joined Governor Lamont's administration, most recently serving as the deputy chief of staff to the governor. And then you were, in 2021, chosen to serve as the senior advisor for the Biden administration. How has your experience working in those different administrations shaped your perspective on state politics specifically?
Yeah, so in the governor's office, I helped work with our agencies on key policies like education, workforce development. I helped build a whole new office of workforce strategy for the state, which includes, you know, 10 different employees, helping to work with our community colleges, our K-12 system to better align for workforce opportunities, helped with transportation projects, a lot of economic development projects to revitalize places like downtown Bridgeport or Stamford to help build more housing and clear out sort of old industrial lots to be more productive parts of our cities. And then during COVID-19, like you mentioned, President Biden tapped Miguel Cardona to be Secretary of Education and me to come along and help oversee the school reopening process for the country during COVID-19. And I think it just showed, you know, I learned a lot more about how to get things done that are actually going to have meaningful impact in the lives of Connecticut residents. You know, it's one thing to just debate these things in an abstract way on the campaign trail, but to be able to actually be at the table with the Commissioner of Education, with our Commissioner of Housing or Commissioner of Transportation, and see how policies that are passed in the legislature can either be very empowering to help those agencies get the job done, or can just be not that helpful and just kind of add more bureaucracy. And what we really need to do is to, in the legislature, set direction and priorities for our agencies to be able to accomplish these big goals, like growing the economy for everybody, like fixing, you know, centuries old infrastructure, like making sure that our schools are treating the whole student, you know, and helping to cut down on absenteeism. So those are some of the things I worked on in the agency, at the agency level and out of the governor's office. And I think it really helped prepare me for these conversations on the campaign trail and hopefully in the state legislature.
You sort of mentioned the importance of outlining your priorities when in politics. And I wanted to ask what you saw as the most pressing challenges facing the 36th district and maybe some ideas that you have to address them.
Yeah. So, you know, economic growth is always a priority. The recent rise in our electric bills is affecting everybody all over the state when families are trying to make ends meet in their budgets, which the cost of living is already so difficult to make ends meet for so many families. For all of a sudden now an electric bill to double, it's just really does a lot of damage to families planning out for the future for themselves and their kids. So now all of a sudden you have to choose between paying your electric bill or being able to, you know, help your child be able to maybe get to that after school program. And so that's something we really have to address and do it in a way that is also friendly for the environment while cutting down on emissions, which is also critical. The second is infrastructure. Our district has the highest percentage of daily commuters of any other state Senate district. So we have I-95 down here, which is the most congested corridor of highway in all of America. So there's more traffic on it than Boston or DC or LA, which some people find hard to believe. Between, you know, Stanford and Norwalk, but it's true. And it kind of just shuts everything down and makes every part of life more difficult. It's bad for the environment when cars are just sitting, you know, for 40, 50, 60 minutes a day, exhausting all of those, the pollutants from the tailpipe. It makes it very difficult for parents to get to work. You know, if you've got to drop your kid off, then get on the highway, wait for an hour, it makes it really difficult. Our trains too should be so much faster to be able to get in and out of the city, and that will also help take cars off the highway. And so if you look at the Department of Transportation's budget for the state, a very, very, very high percentage or actually money is going not towards to address this pressing need here, but to other parts of the state. And so I'd want to work in the legislature to try to make sure we're prioritizing this area, which has the highest percentage of commuters and also the highest rates of congestion. We also have a ton of flooding risk down here. We're right on the coast, and we saw, you know, this summer what happens when massive flooding can really just do chaos in the district and to families. So we need to prepare better for flood mitigation. So those are some of the big ones that I think are on people's minds that we could work on in the Senate.
You seem very in tune with like your constituents and their concerns. Are there any ways that you strategize engaging with the constituents and hearing about what their concerns exactly are during your campaign?
Yeah, it's just all about the doors, all about going out, knocking on doors, making the phone calls. You know, there's really nothing more important in a campaign than just being at the doors, finding every possible way and every minute you can to directly speak to voters, to hear from. I mean, the whole point of running for office is trying to make people's lives better in your community. And there's really no better way to to know how to do that than to talk directly to your voters, to your constituents on both sides of the aisle. So our goal is to do 150,000 knocks and calls. We are on our way to achieving that. I'm generally out 4 to 5 hours a day, if not more, knocking or making calls since June. Well, we've been knocking since April, but now since June is when we're doing 4 to 5 to 6 hours a day. And, you know, like I said, it's my home district. I'm one of five kids. Four of us are back. My parents are still in the same house they bought over 40 years ago. And a lot of the voters I'm talking to are literally, you know, my neighbors, my friends I grew up with, their parents. So it's good to be home and kind of have a sense of how things have been here for the last 30 years and kind of where we are today.
You mentioned that you were a lifelong resident of this district. Do you have any personal experiences and values within the district that really impact your vision for it moving forward?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Definitely. I mean, this is like, you know, I was, you know, bar mitzvahed here, born at Greenwich Hospital, went to the hospital numerous times for injuries, played on the local football teams, went to the schools here. You know, parents are still here now. My wife and I are raising our first child here, and all my nephews and nieces are back in the school system. So I think when families are just trying to do their best, you know, they're trying to create great futures for their kids in the same, you know, systems that me and my siblings grew up in. They're trying to, do well in the business that they're starting where that they've been operating for 40 years. And, you know, I grew up going to that deli or, going to, shopping at that local shoe store, or just took my son to the local toy store that's been here for like 60 years, and they're still operating, or the local bookstore. So I think being able to understand that whole community experience and what makes us so great is really helpful when running for office, because, you know, I've lived their successes and, you know, lived through, you know, the struggles we've faced as well. And it helps paint the picture for where we can go as a community moving forward.
Are there any initiatives that you support to boost economic growth and job creation in the 36th district?
Definitely. We are one of these towns where a lot of the local businesses, the number of them are reducing pretty significantly. So I've seen too many town favorites shut down over the last 15 years. So initiatives to buy local, to make it easier for our local businesses, whether it's through tax credits, helping them with the parking spaces that they need, whether it's through workforce training, which is huge. A big thing I did in the governor's office, health insurance for some of these small businesses has just gotten really, really inaffordable and expensive. The rates of covering health insurance for employees has gone up like 500% over the last 10 to 15 years. So all those initiatives, I think, can help. And then I really do think childcare is a huge thing for the state, that just all workers, especially a lot of the young moms in my district, when childcare costs have gone up exponentially, there's a lot of young moms I know, and my wife is grappling with this as well, that would love to continue working and, you know, fulfilling their dreams, but childcare is so expensive that if they stop working, they can take care of the kids for free. And some dads are dealing with this as well, obviously, but if we can make childcare more affordable and accessible for all, it not only helps set all those kids up for success, but it allows young parents to then be able to go out and keep earning money and, you know, putting food on the table.
Circling back to your work with the Biden administration, how do you think your experience during the pandemic and kind of addressing public health policies color how you're going to kind of take those experiences and apply them to this new role?
Yeah, well, I think one of the biggest challenges facing the entire country is the mental health needs of our young people. And during the COVID pandemic, a lot of my time for the governor and then for President Biden was focused on this insane, 18-month period where so many young people were put under so much stress by not being able to go into school, by not having certainty on whether they would see their friends again in person, for how long that would be, feeling disconnected from the community because just learning in front of a screen is, as we all know, not nearly the same. And for a lot of lower income families and lower income students, I mean, they often didn't even have an internet connection or a laptop, and so went for a very long time in critical periods of their lives being so disconnected from school, and that's one of the reasons you're seeing absenteeism rates in Connecticut. They skyrocketed up to like 27%, 25%, and so I sort of saw firsthand. We were just getting all this data live in the Biden administration, like the CDC would measure rates of mental health, levels of depression, levels of students considering suicide or having suicidal thoughts. I mean, it was just really horrible stuff. And I think we're still recovering today. Students are still recovering, on learning loss for sure, but let alone, their mental health needs. So that is something that I will always live with. And I think it's something we're going to need to spend years of work on helping young people to catch up and overcome a lot of the trauma and, disconnection that was faced during that time period.
Housing costs are rising, of course, throughout the nation, but in Connecticut especially, it's a big issue. Do you have any plans to address the affordable housing crisis in your district?
Definitely, yeah. So when I was in the governor's office, I was proud to work with him and on a budget in 2023 that allocated about $800 million from the state government to address our housing shortages across the state. So Connecticut built the second least amount of new housing of any state over the last five to 10 years. And that's, I think, what you're seeing, Tara, exactly on the rise in inaffordability and just the lack of access. So I really support the governor's approach, which is let's use money, new money that we have, to incentivize building out new housing, because so many places want it, right? The cities want it, the developers are excited to build, and obviously residents are eager for more affordable options. So I think what we need to do is to continue to allocate more of the state budget to building new, affordable housing, but also what's called like workforce housing, which is, a little bit higher up, like more middle class housing, to be able to just create more supply across the state, which will help with the affordability crisis, and then also just help get the economy going again. What we heard, in the governor's office, we talked to countless businesses. A lot of their job was just speaking to businesses and really trying to partner with them to move to Connecticut. And they always asked, like, the first thing they asked was, how can I get my workers to actually afford to live there? They would say, well, maybe I'll just go to Texas because the housing costs there are half as much. It's an issue that it affects everybody and affects all aspects of the state, and something we have to address.
When you were talking about the issues with traffic in your district, it made me think a lot about environmental policies. And I can imagine that area of Connecticut must be much more polluted than other areas of Connecticut. Are there any specific environmental policies or environmental issues that you would like to highlight in your district? And measures that you can take to combat that climate change and protect natural resources?
Yeah, no, you're exactly right, because we, in Connecticut in the mid-1900s, we had the bright idea to build I-95 directly through the middle of some of our biggest cities, right? So if you just look at the map, Metro North and I-95 go directly through Sanford, Norwalk, Bridgeport, and New Haven. And what happens is all that traffic means today that the cars are just sitting in between, right in the middle of our cities. And all of that tailpipe pollution accumulates in the air and just wreaks havoc on the cities. So if you look at the air quality of a place like Bridgeport, for instance, it ranks in like the bottom, 15th percentile for air quality in the United States. And then you look at the effects that that has, all the data shows the effects on asthma rates, the effect on, developmental issues for children when they were breathing in such polluted air. It's horrible. And I think it's an economic injustice that this happens through some our cities that are predominantly black and brown, frankly, those parts of some of the cities that I mentioned. So there is a lot of economic injustice and racial injustice happening here, which is why I'm a huge fan of electric vehicles. They take all that pollution away, right? And we need to obviously modernize our grid and continue to build on our clean power supply through wind and hydro and nuclear, but the first step is transitioning to electric vehicles. My wife and I drive EVs. It was super easy to install charging. We charge overnight, so it doesn't crush our electric bill. The state has great subsidies. We have one of the best EV subsidy programs called Cheaper in the country. And now there's all the federal subsidies. So it's become way more affordable to transition to electric. And so not only is it helping us meet our climate change goals, but if we can do this well, we will have a huge impact on public health, particularly in the in the cities I was mentioning.
In my personal work with College Democrats of Connecticut, I've seen a huge amount of political apathy in young people. And as a young person yourself, what steps do you think are important to take to increase civic engagement for young people and participation among constituents?
Good question. As somebody who taught middle school for 4 years, I'm just so proud of so many of the young people I see in our state, how they've been getting involved. The person that I'm running against is my opponent is one of the most right-wing senators we've had in this area in a very long time. He voted to prosecute women who get abortions in our state. He said Roe v. Wade is an offense against the rule of law. And he almost single-handedly killed the 2023 Connecticut gun safety bill, which banned assault weapons, which empowers police to take guns away from bad actors. And, he won his race by 80 votes out of 45,000. So 0.02%. And after winning by such a small margin, he almost single-handedly sunk the gun safety bill. He filibustered it until 4 a.m. in the morning. And the data already shows that that bill has saved countless lives in Connecticut by gun, from shootings. So I see young people, we're very close to Sandy Hook. The young people who survived that shooting when they were in first grade are now 18, and they've created something called the Newtown Youth Alliance. And they're so inspiring to me because they go across the state and the country advocating for gun safety laws. We have a group here around Stanford called the Greater Young Dems, the sort of Stanford chapter. And they are out knocking every day. They're probably our most committed and passionate constituencies, out knocking every day, making calls. Many of them are running for office, running for the Board of Ed, et cetera. So I've been really inspired. And I think when young people, the more we can do to make it clear, how much every door knock matters, every phone call, right? 80 vote margin in this last election led to almost the sinking of the gun safety bill, right? So you could knock 80 doors, in 4 hours. So it really, really makes a difference and has huge impact on what happens up at the legislature. So the more we can just make sure young people understand that your voice, you can really, really make a difference. I think the better we'll be.
I have one last question for you, but it's a really important one. For those who are inspired by your vision and want to support your campaign, what are some ways that they can get involved in your campaign and make a difference in the 36th district?
Well, we would love to have as many as possible come make calls to knock on doors. You can go to nicksimmons4ct.com and sign up to volunteer right there. You can phone bank from anywhere in the world. We make it really, really easy. We just give you a call list. I think voters love to hear from passionate volunteers. So if you're passionate about some of the issues that I mentioned, doesn't matter if you are calling from, you know, from Meriden, Connecticut, or from London, England, or wherever, the passion always translates. So we would love that. And then if you're able to come down and actually knock doors, we are, as I mentioned, right off I-95. You can get through the traffic and come knock with us. It's really fun. We've got Treasurer Eric Russell coming out, the governor. We've got Senator Murphy and Congressman Himes, and a lot of just great local pockets of volunteers. So we would love to have you all come out with you. And I just want to hear from you, too, what's on your mind and what can we do to make this state a better place?
Nick Simmons is among the many candidates who earned the cross endorsement of Connecticut's Independent Party. This is kind of a interesting facet of politics in Connecticut, in that if you ask just regular voters what they think it means to be an independent voter, they think it means, well, sometimes I vote for Democrat, sometimes I vote for Republican, I'm not enrolled in either party, that's an independent. In Connecticut, we tend to call that unaffiliated. However, there is an actual independent party, and they often, sometimes they run individual candidates, but more often than not, they cross-endorse one of the Democrats or one of the Republicans. And this year, Nick won the Independent Party endorsement, so he'll appear on the Democratic line, but he'll have a second line as well, where his name will appear. And, you know, doesn't matter where you vote for him, the votes count either way. Independent Party made a little news this year.
They announced that they are giving almost like a pledge or a statement to the candidates that they endorse, basically stating that they strongly support free and fair elections and the rule of law, reject all the kind of actions that happened on January 6th that attempted to prevent a peaceful transfer of power, and that they accept all elections past and future as certified by election officials. I think that this is incredibly important work that the Independent Party is doing. The near 16,000 people that are active voters registered with the Independent Party, I hope that they take this to heart and they realize how important this is. I actually am taking a class in election policy in Connecticut, currently at school, and just learning how the election system works makes me feel more trust in it than ever. And I think it's incredibly important that our politicians also have that kind of trust in our systems as well.
Again, the last sentence of the portion of the pledge that you read was, in order to be a candidate, endorsed by the Independent Party, one had to sign a statement that included, I accept the results of all elections past and future as certified by election officials. A couple of Republicans in Connecticut took great offense to that, including, John Oliver's favorite Connecticut senator.
Last year, he was the lone no vote in the state Senate on a resolution exonerating the victims of the 17th century Connecticut witch trials. Partly because, and I quote, he didn't want to paint America as a bad place with a bad history.
Rob Sampson. He is a Republican, represents Walcott and I think Southington and a number of towns in that area, who put out a lengthy statement sort of rejecting the notion that the Independent Party should even ask people to do this. He says, I urge voters to this is Rob Sampson, Republican state senator, urging voters to scrutinize candidates who have accepted the Independent Party's endorsement. To do so likely means adopting positions that conflict with Republican values and publicly aligning with a far-left perspective on January 6th, aimed at harming the campaign of former President Trump. A, you cannot harm the campaign of President Trump in Connecticut. It is dead on arrival. But leaving that aside, here's what he claims is a far left perspective on January 6th. We're going to go over that again. reject the actions on January 6th that attempted to prevent the peaceful transfer of power for the first time in the history of the United States. That is a far left perspective in the opinion of not only Rob Sampson, but a couple of other people running on your ballot on the Republican line in Connecticut this year. It's unbelievable.
So following that logic, that must mean that anyone who has ever accepted the elections in the past 400 near years of American history must have been a far left Democrat too, right?
I guess. I mean, just accepting the results of all elections as certified by election officials is entry level, basic, standard for being a candidate. That notion that you call your opponent, when you've lost, you call your opponent and you say, nice things and you concede gracefully and da da da. That has happened for the longest time. I mean, I remember 2016, Hillary Clinton coming out rather late at night on election night, or perhaps it was the next day or whatever, when it was clear that the votes weren't there, and conceding. Like, the concession is an enormous part. And the only person to not do it is Donald Trump. And now the notion that one would accept all elections past and future appears to be a bridge too far for Rob Sampson and a couple of the other people on your ballot, no matter where you live in Connecticut, on the Republican line. It's horrifying.
And I just want to make it so clear, when you really look at the way that elections are run in this country from top to bottom, there are so many measures to keep our elections integrate. And it's such a well thought out process. And I have so much respect for our poll workers and everyone who volunteers to be a part of these processes. And to disrespect those people who oftentimes spend their free time doing this, counting votes, doing the late night hours, and discredit their work is such a shame to me. And I really just want to ask the question to these people, if we don't believe in our elections, then what are you doing? Then why are you even running? Then what is the point of all of this? And like, where do you see the future of this? And I don't think that they even realize how decreasing the faith in our public institutions is going to even impact them long term as well.
Yeah, in Connecticut, that's a good point. Everything is very bipartisan on the election administration, from the fact that every town has both a Democratic and a Republican registrar of voters. There are two registrars of voters in each town. So in a very Democratic place like New Haven, there's a Republican registrar. In a very Republican place like Rob Sampson's Walcott, there is a Democratic registrar. And that balance, they generally work well together. I think there's, out of 169 towns, I'll bet you 160 of them, everybody gets along nicely. It works well. And on election night, there's, Republican volunteers checking people in, crossing off names, handing out the ballots, standing by the tabulators, all that stuff. And then reading the tape at the end of the night, there's a supervisor, or I forget what the term is, but the person in charge on election night of tabulating the votes, one Democrat, one Republican, and they have to look at the thing and ultimately agree on a number that's sent to the Secretary of State. And it's not hard because, generally speaking, there's not problems. But if there were some issue or problem, there's a Democrat and Republican there. And if it comes down to less than, I think, 0.5% of the vote, that recount is all done by equal numbers of Democrats and Republicans hand reviewing each ballot. It is an incredibly good system here in Connecticut. And generally, we get results reasonably fast, within 24 hours at the most. But for the most part, by 11 o'clock, we'll know the outcomes in most of these races.
And isn't it so strange that the outcomes are only ever questioned when Democrats win?
Bizarre, because
it's weird, right? That's the only time that mistakes are made, or when Democrats win.
And sometimes there can be two races on a ballot, one of which is called into question and the other is clearly okay.
It's confusing to me also, because I try to put myself in the mind of a politician and I'm like, if I want people to come out and vote for me, why would I question the integrity of voting? Like, that's just so strange. It's almost as if they are discouraging voter participation, which is harrowing to me, because I'm like, as people who work in politics, our main goal is always get people out to vote, get people involved, get people caring, because that's what makes your systems work for you. So trying to push people out of the system too just really doesn't make sense.
They've trapped themselves between an electoral rock and hard place by discrediting early voting and discrediting mail voting and saying that those are somehow ripe with fraud, when they aren't, provably are not. And so now they want to try to get people to go out and early vote. They're finding they're having a hard time. In Connecticut, we're enjoying the early vote for the first time in a general election this year. It's going to start on October 21st and run each day to November 3rd. That includes Saturday and Sunday. So, you know, 14 days in a row, you can go and vote in person at a voting location in your town. It'll be slightly different than your normal voting location because it's one per town generally. Larger cities may have two, but you can find that information on ctdems.org. We'll be linking to all of that stuff. But yeah, you get to run from 10 to 6 every day. There are extended hours a couple of nights to go from 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. But generally speaking, I kind of wonder how many people are going to early vote this year.
I'm incredibly excited to see how many people take advantage of this opportunity. I think it's so great for people who work late nights, for people who have kids and can't manage making it to the polls. I hope this is going to make things easier for people and more accessible and definitely bring more people out to vote.
What about electoral junkies like myself who treat Election Day like the Super Bowl and are so worked up on Election Day that they kind of like getting out to vote is actually a pain in the neck? I can get this out of the way starting October 21st. I'm thrilled.
I can vote early and then just sit and watch the numbers on Election Day. So that's going to be very exciting.
If you would like to help out with getting these people elected, for getting people out to vote, for participating in early voting, you can find a campaign office near you. We now have them open in, it's got to be 30 or 40 towns and cities across Connecticut. Your best bet is to check out ctdems.org/events and find something close to you. We hope to see you out on the campaign trail as we head into the home stretch. You know, we're about less than 6 weeks away.
Get out to vote, do something about the election if you can, and we will be talking to you all next week.